I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
So, we're going to be discussing this book, which I have a proof copy of here, which has, this one you will note is 60s retro, whereas that one is 50s retro. Mm-hmm. A sort of brutalist cover and sort of people's detailing cover. Lots of you, I suspect, will know John's work from the blog Municipal Dreams, which has been going for how many years now?
4 years.
4 years. And which has sort of increasingly become a sort of comprehensive resource for not just municipal housing, but sort of municipal projects in general and the sort of reshaping of British cities in the 20th century by local government and the kind of fate of it. So as I've sort of been reading it avidly for that time, I have many questions. And the book sort of takes the sort of housing part of that and concentrates on that, I think, for obvious reasons, given its extreme topicality. Pretty much the only thing I've ever had with it is the fact that, despite the fact that John is a former Winchester City Councillor for the Labour Party, he has never covered the city of Southampton. I hope that one day this will be redressed. So without further ado, the first question would be, why municipal housing? If you compare sort of mass housing, or sort of mass non-market housing in Britain to, say, Germany or Sweden, it's quite conspicuous how much of it that's been done specifically by local authorities, as opposed to, in Germany, trade union building societies, and Sweden housing associations, usually backed by the Social Democratic Party, instead being done very directly by the state, but the local state. And I was wondering why that came about specifically.
Yeah, well, you can all hear me, can you? This is working. Great. That's a good question, and I think I only got sort of a series of 10 quite difficult questions, so I'm sort of slightly nervous as I sit here, and it's my first book event, so thanks for coming, everybody. And thanks for people that have tweeted and supported the blog in the meantime, which is really helpful and really appreciated. That's all padding before I answer the question. In terms of the question, I think it's a very interesting question, and I'm thinking of my feet, to be honest, in part. I mean, the easy part is the failure of 5% philanthropy, the failure of philanthropic housing in the Victorian era. That was, you know, that begins in the 1860s, takes off further into the century, and there was this Victorian paternalist philanthropic notion that a form of housing association could be formed with support of wealthy investors, 5% return, and that would meet the housing needs of the urban population.
Just to sort of stop you briefly, it's probably worth explaining what 5% philanthropy was for those that won't know.
Yeah.
I mean, the name kind of says it all to a large degree, but you say you've sort of got, I mean, you could give a better explanation than me.
Yeah, well, I mean, Octavia Hill is probably the person who's best known, but there was a various sort of artisans and labourers, dwellings companies and so on. Some 30-odd of those enterprises in London alone in the sort of mid-19th century. And they were established by, as I mentioned, by Victorian liberal reformers who hoped that by building their own their model dwellings, that they would in that way rehouse the working class, the urban working class of the city. Various problems with that. The main problem was the level of the rents, which are too high for all but the well-off and more affluent working class, and indeed the middle class, lower middle class, were quite significant occupiers of these working class dwellings, in fact. The other main problem was that they simply couldn't build at scale. The model didn't work. And in the meantime, of course, the private rental sector, as we know to the present day, simply had no interest in building affordable housing, and I'm using that term in a literal and appropriate sense in this context. The private rentals, private builders had no interest, no commercial gain for them in building low-cost housing for rental for the working classes. In terms of the rise of municipal housing, obviously the great coincidence of two currents really occurs in 1889-1890, a combination in London specifically, but across the country, of the formation of London County Council, which became one of the foremost builders of council housing throughout its fairly august history in that context, and in 1890 the Housing of the Working Classes Act, which emerges after a series of sort of fairly paltry and faltering legislative attempts to first of all legislate and regulate sanitary conditions, and then in very minor cases to enable municipal building or municipal subsidy of building. But it's that combination of a local government structure, a machinery of states, a machinery of local state with national support, and the legislative imprimatur from above, I guess. Just quickly, and sorry I'm talking slightly too long, but I guess Owen's question actually raises another question, which is why did housing associations not emerge in the way that it did on the continent? And I suspect that, I've got my kind of labour historian hat on here rather than my housing hat, I think that sort of lies more in the fact that the labour subculture in Britain, the sort of trade union and working class subculture, was fairly attenuated. It was very very focused on parliamentary means and limited industrial action. There was no real labour subculture in that way. Trade unions focus very much on labour representation and industrial relations, but didn't see themselves in performing a larger role for the most part.
So, I mean, some of those criticisms that one can sort of make of sort of charitable housing in the late 19th century can also be made of the first generation of council housing. As you point out, the boundary in Shoreditch, which is frequently claimed as the first, although you have other examples, I think now demolished in Liverpool?
Yes.
As the actual first. So Liverpool was first and then they got rid of it. So London has the first extant social housing, public housing. But that was, to a large degree, for the sort of deserving working class or above. The people sort of moved on from the old nickel slum that was formerly on the site, didn't manage to sort of to get flats on what was built in its place for all their undoubted qualities. So in many ways, the sort of takeoff is in the interwar years, which seems to come sort of partly from the sort of idea that municipal housing would be a sort of reward for service, the sort of homes for heroes idea, and also for a sort of much more sort of strongly socialist idea coming from John Wheatley, was the housing minister of the very, very brief Labour government of 1924, before the Daily Mail and MI5 brought it down. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that interwar moment and where that kind of that sort of intensification of council housing comes from.
Yeah. And of course, it's a debate around council housing, and part of that debate is actually around the impact of the First World War. Because it's pretty clear, you know, that in terms of legislation, in terms of the machinery, local government machinery, that was all in place before the First World War. And if you look at the kind of detailed data, there was a significant rise in council house construction from 1910 onwards. But probably nationally, not more than 24,000 council houses were built across the country before 1914. So obviously, despite that structure and that impetus towards building council housing, it didn't really take off until after the First World War, as Owen rightly points out, and as most people know. The obvious thing, and it's clear to everybody here, is the Homes for Heroes program of the Addison Act of 1919. Either, as you'll know, either as a reward for the sacrifice of the British working class, either on the Western Front or on the home front, some definite notion that should be rewarded, that their full participation in society should be recognised. There were, of course, other much more difficult currents, so far as the government was concerned. Obviously, the Glasgow rent strike in 1915, huge movement of protesting against increased private rents at the time, which were subsequently frozen in consequence. So there were the second fear, of course, in conjunction with the Russian Revolution, was that the working class might turn nasty, that they might become revolutionary. That seems unlikely in the British context, but there certainly was very significant militancy in the First World War around the shop stewards movement, around the rent strikes, and so on. But the other important thing to say, so I've identified two currents there, one being obviously Homes for Heroes, the reward element, two being the SOP, the palliative to the fear of working class militancy. The third one, which is kind of needs to be understood, is simply that the private sector could not, would not, but actually really could not provide housing at scale for working class people in 1919 at war's end. The whole system was in crisis. Rents were frozen. They had to stay frozen given the sort of labour conditions of the time. So there was no interest in private rental. Private rental sector was dead to all intents and purposes at that point. Speculative builders had no interest, as we discussed already. So in 1918, 1919, I mean, the discussions begin in the middle of the war as to what's going to happen afterwards around housing. So by the war's end, there is a consensus, a cross-party consensus, that if the working class are going to be decently housed, it's going to have to be done through the action of the local and national states, simply because the private market sector could not possibly meet that need.
This sort of idea of it being a cross-party consensus is something I'll come back to presently. But one thing that's also a sort of consensus at that point is about the form for this sort of expansion of council housing that happens in the 20s and 30s, which, apart from a few experiments in sort of high-density inner-city housing in London, Liverpool and Leeds, is otherwise the cottage estate. And one of the things that's always sort of intrigued me in Municipal Dreams as a blog, and it's sort of repeated in the book, is that you're coming at this very much from the angle of a social historian rather than an architectural historian, which I think is very necessary. It's far too much kind of like, wow, isn't this building beautiful? Wouldn't it be great if we all moved into it and privatized it? Going on around at the moment. So, but sort of partly as a sort of architectural historian of a sort, but also as a former inhabitant of a cottage estate, which I deeply disliked on aesthetic and social grounds, I've always sort of been sort of interested in where that idea of not just of the sort of expansion of the garden city idea to house the working class, but also the extremely low densities of that housing. Where did this come from?
Well, technically, of course, it came from the Tudor Walters Report in 1918. I referenced the sort of work that was done during the war to anticipate post-war needs. And the Tudor Walters Report was, of course, the template for what happened subsequently. And very low densities, around 12 homes per acre. The roots of that, I think, are twofold. And one is, and contrary, you know, sort of proud urbanists like Owen get kind of a bit annoyed by this, but it seems to be the case that the labour movement, as articulated, expressed in their own kind of desires and wishes for housing, wanted a house and a garden. That was overwhelmingly the language and aspiration of the time. This was, when we talk about labour movement, we're talking about, skilled working class, relatively affluent working class, so, they could perhaps aspire to this form of housing. But that was always the gold standard, I think, from the pre-war period, and certainly, into the post First World War period. So that's, if as it were, the voice of the people, if I rhetorically call it that. But it combines obviously with kind of the arts and crafts sensibilities of people like Unwin and Sir Raymond Unwin, obviously the Garden City movement and Ebenezer Howard. So there are, in terms of planning, those planning currents which are emerging from the 1880s, 1890s are also very much emphasising the cottage. Not necessarily cottage suburb, not necessarily Beckentree, with a population of 120,000 population. That was the kind of scale and enormity they probably didn't anticipate or particularly respect. But I think in terms of that basic two-storey house with a garden, with the healthy kind of salubrious suburban character around it, I think that's what was desired.
I suppose what I found interesting in that moment is if you contrast it with similar housing coming out of sort of the labour movement in say the Weimar Germany or in the Netherlands, it's also suburban and it also frequently includes houses with gardens. And you've written about these very well on the blog and briefly in the book. But aesthetically, there's this shift into something much more sort of abstract and radical. And I suppose that doesn't really hit Britain, with a couple of minor exceptions, until after the war. So what do you think was behind this sort of quite sudden shift in the late 40s and 50s from the kind of cottage estate and these sort of endless sort of looping cul-de-sacs and big front and back gardens to the much more sort of urban image of the post-war inner city council estate, and particularly the sort of most notorious and probably now partly half most criticised, half most celebrated aspect of this, which is the Tower Block?
Yeah. That's another big question.
It's a big book.
Yeah, well... read the book. You'll probably get more coherent answers, hopefully, from the book. If anyone doesn't mind, I will briefly backtrack also, because it is absolutely true to say that modernist ideas did not take off in interwar Britain compared to what you can see in Berlin and so on. It's interesting because councillors did go on these kind of delegations. They did visit Vienna, they did visit Paris and Berlin and so on, and came away thinking, it was all very nice, but not really quite suitable. Quarry Hill in Leeds, which some of you, it's demolished in the late 1970s, was, really the one scheme which kind of emulated and actually exceeded those kind of Viennese models.
Perhaps some Liverpool is also an interesting one, insofar as Liverpool built a lot of sort of very Viennese, sort of red Vienna-style housing as part of a sort of sectarian settlement under a Tory council, which I've always thought was rather extraordinary.
They did. They had a very fascinating city architect, Lancelot Keys, that really did some fantastic work. Liverpool, I think, as my family will tell you, is a story unto itself, really. So it's hard to sort of talk about Liverpool as being anything other than distinct and separate culturally. But it did have a strong urbanist culture from the outset. And did build, along with the LCC, 20% of housing in Liverpool was flatted in the interwar period, but they also built very large council suburbs. Yeah. But modernism didn't take off. The Ossulton estate is the one that kind of looks a bit modernist next to the British Library, a lot of you will have seen, flat is to deceive, really. I should answer the question in terms of post-Second World War period. It's a kind of slow burn, I think. The key thing that happens is really, again, planning, kind of urban planning, town planning, and the idea of planning per se, which takes off in the 30s, but doesn't find voice and power until obviously 1945. City of London plan at Abercrombie. It's the 75th anniversary this year, so I'll be speaking at an event to celebrate that later on in the year. Patrick Abercrombie in London envisaged the London population falling by 360,000, or at least 360,000 people being moved to the new towns and so on. But as part of that program, he recognised that you had to build at higher densities in the inner city. That was also had been, you know, recognised in the five-storey tenements. We haven't talked about those. They don't kind of conform to any kind of glorious urbanism or modernism, but they are, of course, a really important intrinsic reality of council housing in inner London. But in the post-war period, it was recognised you had to build at density, which was one thing. So there was a sort of almost a sort of implicit. It wasn't a sort of articulated embrace of high rise, but it was a sort of de facto recognition that it was going to be necessary. There was, of course, no expectation it would house families with children at that point. The other thing that happens, I think, in terms of the move towards multi-storey is, secondly, the rise of, well, a realization that the overwhelmingly preponderant form of council housing up to 45 had been these two-story homes, two-bed, three-bed council houses, family housing. By 1945, it was very clear that form of housing simply wasn't catering for a very significant swathe of people, elderly people, single-person households, couples, whatever.
So people that wanted to live near to pubs in the city centre and didn't want to be in this sort of like rather sort of already quite criticised, environments that were quite criticised for the sort of desolation and homogeneity in many ways. I suppose that's what is interesting.
That's your spin.
Well, but that's what I suppose what I'm getting at here is that what sort of happens in the 40s that I find interesting with the sort of shift into modernism is that it's the first time that sort of aesthetics get incredibly politicised in the way people discuss council housing. Something which then happens again and again and again. That if you sort of read things like Thomas Sharp's book, Town Planning, which is sort of hugely popular Pelican published in the 40s that thousands and thousands of people read, that's just total blanket condemnation of the cottage estate. Completely kind of like, this is worthless, it wastes land, it's desolate, it's pointless, it's bleak. And then this other thing is set up, which then, by the end of the 60s, is then being criticised on a whole other sort of new set of grounds. So it sort of becomes a sort of aesthetico-political football in a way. And I suppose what interests me a lot in this is the way that you sort of trace quite a lot the media response, which initially seems to be very, very positive to the shift towards the multi-storey. There seems to be a lot of, you know, the Princess Anne goes and opens a block of flats in Woolwich. All this sort of bizarre stuff now. Also a lot of detail on the sociology of sort of people initially being quite positive about this stuff. And then it sort of curdles. And then the sort of sociologists and then the media, it's not quite clear what happens first, start to sort of reconceptualize these from being the sort of brave new world into being the sort of terrible dystopian failure. And I'm sort of even sort of before Ronan Point, this is starting to happen, and after Ronan Point's collapse, the collapse of the sort of system-built tower in Poplar, that this kind of this huge sort of wave then comes in. And what do you think's behind that wave? Do you find those criticisms to be justified? Do you think that there is something that went wrong?
Well, it's the long move towards multi-story, and just as a caveat, I'd emphasise that, you know, high-rise tower blocks, of course, became the kind of iconic image of council housing, became the kind of dirty story of council housing, I guess, and we'll come back to that. But it was a slow burn, you know. I think in terms of sort of golden ages of council housing, I identify the 1970s, which is after the kind of high-rise boom. I'd also look at the 1950s, in fact, because I think in the context of emergent high-rise, you need to talk about mixed development, and because that was a big idea in the 50s, and that was both an architectural and a kind of sociological concept. Architecturally, it was really important because they did take the view that the cottage suburbs were dull and monolithic and boring, and they certainly didn't give architects much scope to exhibit flair or daring. So there was architecturally a shift towards mixed development, which was a mix of low rise, medium rise, and sort of growing high rise. But the sociological aspect of mixed development, of course, was to cater for that mixed population that I mentioned. What happens, of course, 1956 is usually taken as kind of the turning point. I think that's probably more of a sort of a signifier of a shift that was taking place and going to take place anyway. But the high-rise subsidy in 56 is sort of conventionally taken to mark the point at which high-rise became de rigueur or more expected. I think... there is a kind of, I think what happens in the 60s is two things. I mean, up to the mid 50s, basically most new housing is concentrated on, dealing with the immediate post-war crisis, rehousing those affected by the Blitz or living in damaged homes. Slum clearance and rehousing becomes really the kind of motif and the single driver of council housing from the mid-50s into the 60s, really for the rest of its lifespan. And I think in combination with the kind of the political arms race of the 1960s, when conservative governments, this is kind of ironic nowadays, of course, but when the Conservative Party and the Labour Party were engaging in a sort of a race to the top in terms of who could build most housing and as part of that council housing in huge numbers, that drive to clear the slums once and for all, to clear the scourge of the slums, which were prevalent in huge numbers at the time, and people tend to forget that now in their sort of romanticisation of the Victorian terrace. So that drive to clear the slums and to rebuild, I think, does create that dynamic to build at scale, and at scale increasingly means building at height. And of course, given those drivers, given that kind of political imperative, obviously is also the move in the mid-60s to use system building. Nothing intrinsically wrong with system building. It's a perfect solution in the machine age and in the technocratic age, the white hot heat of the technological revolution that Harold Wilson talked about in 63. System building was an obvious way forward. It just was very badly implemented for the most part in the British context.
I suppose on a social level, I suppose what I'm trying to get at, what's so interesting in this is that it's an issue that's been sort of, it's frequently treated in this very emotive way. People have this sort of very, very sort of over-the-top language when talking about it. And this sort of sidesteps that completely and has a sort of much more sober sociological take. So if one were to kind of open a newspaper in the mid-1970s and, if you had Google in 1976, if you sort of search for the word tower block, a whole load of associations would have come with. And also if you search for the word municipal, a whole lot of associations have come with that, which I think at that point would have been almost universally negative. And one of the most important things in this is the attention that you give to the 1970s and to the sort of reaction against the sort of Macmillan and Wilson sort of battle for numbers and almost a sort of much more relaxed period of council housing in which the sort of criticisms are in some ways being listened to, and there are quite a lot of interesting experiments. You mentioned particularly Camden Council and Camden Council's quite extraordinary housing program, and also Bicker and Newcastle. And these sort of suggest that these things that were kind of being treated very much at the time as being monolithic actually were responding to criticism and responding in some ways to local democracy. So I suppose what I would ask is whether or not you think there's sort of any sort of justification behind the very, very frequent criticisms of council housing from the left in the 1970s. We'll go on to the right in a moment, but and first of all, there's a sort of huge critique from the left, the kind of libertarian left, anarchism. One of the kind of the most read writers on housing, probably by non-architects, is Colin Ward, who has a sort of passionate opposition to council housing of any sort, calls it municipal landlordism, and ended up with this rather bizarre position where he thought we should all live in Jaywick. But there's a kind of You know, do you think that there's any sort of truth in this? And do you find that there's sort of libertarian alternatives to it that were proposed, such as self-build, which Lewisham Council kind of dallied with for a bit? Do you think there was any real credence to this? Do you think that the criticisms were justified? And can you imagine us a more libertarian mass housing, or is such a thing a contradiction in terms? Sorry, well, that's a lot of questions.
Yeah. Well, given
were the anarchists wrong, or were they right? Were they stupid, or were they clever?
They were wrong and they were stupid.
Good. I'm glad we established that.
Can we move on? I'm a bit old school in this context. If you've read the blog, if you read the book, hopefully, I celebrate municipalism. I'm not blind, of course, to its failings. And there were failings. I think those failings probably were quite powerful in the 1970s. I think, the history of sort of tenants' responses to housing is very interesting, you know, and media responses to it as well. And it is a very shifting story, you know. I think we're dominated by a single narrative at the moment. I think it's good to take that long view, which is what I try and do. In terms of the kind of critiques that emerged in the 70s, I think it's true to say that a lot of housing departments did become rather hidebound. They did become paternalistic in the kind of rather bad way. They were sort of bad fathers rather than good fathers in that context. Housing departments were very kind of paternalistic, actually quite matriarchal in the 20s and 30s, because given the role of sort of lady housing inspectors, formidable women that would check that the sheets were clean and so on. So there is a powerful tradition of council house paternalism, alongside with the sort of estate-based caretakers that also kind of ruled the roost and clipped the then perpetrators what wasn't then called antisocial behaviour around the ear and sent them packing. And of course, a lot of that sort of enforced respectability, if that's which is kind of what it was embraced and welcomed by the rather respectable working class that predominantly occupied council housing. I think what happens by the 60s, and this is kind of way too inchoate to be a very kind of coherent response, but I think there is a decline of deference. On the one hand, there is that there is a rejection of that kind of top-down, rather heavy-handed paternalism. It is also the case, I think, that council housing budgets, even in the 70s, are becoming restricted. I think they are failing to invest in maintenance and adequate repair services and so on. So I think the kind of criticisms that emerge. And of course, alongside that, you do have genuine construction problems in system building and so on. So there's a lot going on in the 70s. So I think one can understand where that kind of anarchist critique, where that sort of left critique comes from. But I think it kind of marks a moment. In terms of alternatives, I'm a pretty simple soul, honestly. And I kind of like the model of the Public Works Loans Board, low cost. Subsidies, always paid off, of course, so not a subsidy in any true sense of the word. It's a very simple model. It was a very effective one for decades of housing history. And while I pay due respect to some very interesting initiatives promoted then and being promoted now in terms of self-building and community land trust and that, and this is all good stuff, and these are interesting models, but overwhelmingly, of course, the simple reality is they're very small scale, and they tend to expect people to be activist. Actually, most people don't want to be activist. They want to they want decent landlords. They want we all want whether you're renting privately or renting publicly, as it were, you just want somebody that's going to do their job, look after the house. You don't want to be involved in your housing other than a bit of DIY and a bit of gardening. So I'm very sceptical of the kind of models which require that degree of commitment and political engagement.
You don't want to build your own house.
No, it wouldn't be a good idea.
This is obviously the book about the rise and fall of social housing. So we're moving on to the fall. What, which there's a lot of detail on this, a lot of very, very good detail that is sort of often sort of detail you want to sort of whack people over the head with in many cases. But the one of the sort of central kind of puzzles of it is the way that the Tory party moves from being an institution which actually built huge quantities of council housing in the interwar years and in the 50s, built tons of it, to a sort of much more radical right movement that sort of starts to reconceptualise the very idea of council housing as a socialist one. I hope sort of Thatcher decides sort of brands a whole load of things that parts of her party had previously been committed to as socialist. These things that weren't previously considered socialist are now considered socialist. And I suppose, where do you think this sort of animus, how does this animus sort of seep into the Tory party, and how does it manage to become so popular, and how do people fall so easily for the right to buy?
I think there's an interesting story to be told about sort of conservative policy towards council housing. In the long story, I think there's a really, for me, what I perceive is a really important kind of cleavage between kind of basically broadly left-wing Labour views and Tory views towards council housing, even when both parties were building in at scale. And for Conservatives, the notion was that council housing was always for those that could aspire to know better. Essentially housing of last resort, housing for those with special needs in some shape or form, slummy housing notably. And that was clear in the legislation in the 1920s and in the 1930s and in the 1950s. So there was that division. And of course, I think we briefly mentioned this. Obviously, for a key moment in its history, at least, Labour wholeheartedly always had this kind of vague notion that housing, that council housing should serve a cross-section of community. That was, you know, legislated in 1948 when the stipulation that council housing be considered working class housing, be designated as such, was removed. And of course Bevan was the great spokesman for that communal ideal. The mixed tapestry of the living tapestry of a mixed community. The Tories always saw it as second-rate housing for a subset of the community. That's, I think, the sort of the background to the big change that Owen identifies. What happens in the 70s, I think, is partly all the trouble that we've identified in the 70s. You know, there is a shift. There is a shift in perception towards council housing. It is having been overwhelmingly celebrated in the 60s, fairly universally sort of slagged off in the 70s. So there is a cultural shift there to which the Tories, in a sense, are both sort of agents and responders to. The other shift, of course, is that owner occupation is rising. That, you know, working class owner occupation is becoming a thing, becoming a significant phenomenon by the 60s into the 70s. So whereas for working class people, up to the 60s at least, council housing was really the best you could aspire to, and it was a good thing to aspire to, so I'm not saying that in any kind of negative way. Whereas by the time working class owner occupation is emerging in the 60s, it becomes quite a second tier, second rung on the ladder. And you can see the opinion polling of the time records that shift amongst working class people. So there's this sort of broad transition, I think, to which the Conservatives could be seen as both, as I said, both sort of cause and consequence in a sense. But the other thing that happens, of course, with Thatcher is really the rise of the new right in the 70s. So you've got, you know, Hayek and Friedman, you've got Keith Joseph's Reading List. So this is a new form of conservatism. You know, this is not, and these are sort of simple terms, but they have some validity. You know, this is a shift from one nation Toryism. It is a shift towards new right ideology, and that view that council housing promoted a dependency culture, that it you know, impeded social mobility, that it in a restricted enterprise, became very powerful in the 70s. Really became the sort of driving force of the Thatcherite revolution, really. And last but not least, the simple fact, but the undeniable fact, and this, you know, you can, this is pretty documented, the assumption being that the correct assumption as it happens, that council housing promoted Labour voting, was also a very good reason to promote own occupation and to sort of reduce the impact and scale of council housing.
I sort of idea which has a remarkable tenacity. It was very telling of sort of Nick Clegg saying after, in his sort of confessions of the coalition, that he had proposed building more social housing to Cameron, and it only breeds Labour voters. But I was going to ask lots of things about New Labour and about New Labour's sort of attempt to try and continue some sort of affordable or social housing while relentlessly denigrating council housing. But we're running out of time, so I'm going to ask what's going to be my last question, which was, if you were to pick two or three favourites, like examples of municipal housing you think are just tip-top, the best that was built, or just personal things that have a place in your personal canon, what would they be?
Yeah, so because I'm not going to pick a whole lot of cottage suburbs just to annoy you.
Some sort of cottage suburb somewhere in the outer reaches of the West Midlands. That's, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't know, I'll offend anybody by picking the wrong ones or not mentioning your own favourites or your own place of residence. But I mean, I'm really keen on the old oak estate in Hammersmith, which is a pre-1914, pre-First World War estate, which really is the kind of acme of that kind of arts and crafts pastoralism and beautiful housing. Dover House Estate in Putney. Immediate post First World War is really the acme of Homes for Heroes. Similarly, really beautiful arts and crafts cottage estate. It's now a kind of very desirable enclave in Putney, according to the Evening Standard Home and Property section, for very good reason. But I will extend beyond that form of housing. I'm really fond of Churchill Gardens. Churchill Gardens in 2001 was voted by the Civic Trust was selected as being the most sort of the best housing development of the post-war period of the previous 40 years, and I think Churchill Gardens is a stunning achievement built by Westminster City Council, a Conservative council, in the post-war period by two architects aged about 23 and 24 at the time. So it really does capture that sort of that the height of that post-war idealism. So Churchill Gardens is great. These are all London examples, aren't they? I mean, I'm obviously fond of Park Hill. I'm rather sorry about what's happening to it now.
That's for three. You've got four. So it's time for questions.
No. Okay.
questions.
Well, my question probably leads on from that at the end there. As somebody on the left who spent 2 years trying to defeat the HDV in Haringey, I always get this panic situation because Labour itself, Labour authorities have got, especially on the left, have always had a bit of a, in my view, when they get to take over radical housing policy, they kind of bottle it. Now, I look back at, you know, Lebetkin and Finsbury and I think of Liverpool in the early 80s, it always seems to be, and of course Sidney Cook, you know, Ken Livingstone and his influence there. Do Labour always bottle it when given the opportunity to do something different and radical?
Yeah, the most important thing about Camden is that it was the third wealthiest authority in London in that period, of Sidney Cook. And, you know, I should have mentioned, of course, Owen's referencing already, but you know, those superb housing schemes in Camden, also in Lambeth, Cressingham Gardens, Central Hill, currently under threat. So I'd like to support those, their survival, and not their regeneration as proposed. The thing about Camden was that it was a very wealthy authority. It was a young and radical authority in terms of its councillors, so there was a moment there. But, you know, money is a driving force. Do Labour councils always bottle it?
I think left Labour councils, I guess, is the answer. I suppose what it was referring to, which is worth kind of spelling out for those that don't know it, is that when the left got hold of Camden under Ken Livingstone at that point, before he got control of the GLC group, they immediately stopped the sort of now much praised sort of modernist housing programme and went for rehabilitating old terraces instead. So I suppose that's the question then, is that what about the sort of the sort of non-mainstream Labour left?
Well, I'm getting lots of kind of I'm getting slightly mixed messages, I suppose. So it's quite hard to know how to respond. I mean, municipalism, which you know the sort of purchase of large swathes of private rental property, was actually a very positive policy, I think, enabled. It provided housing in larger numbers, which slum clearance couldn't, because you couldn't build at that density. So it made good sense. You know, that Islington and Camden and so on pursued that policy. I'm going to try to get back to this question whether they bottle or not. I think as a local councillor, as somebody that celebrates local government, warts and all, the fundamental reality of British politics, because I used to teach A-level politics as well, and you could summarise it in three words to sort of, you know, the British constitution, is Parliament is sovereign. Local government, you know, and this is where you clash, of course, with alternative history, such as Milton, and we'll see what happens in Harrogate. But local government can only do what it's allowed to do. It can only do what it's permitted to afford to do, how it's allowed to spend. So, and you know, the Labour Party is an intensely constitutionalist party. Is a social democratic party. It has broadly pursued moderate politics for that time, and these are difficult phrases to apply and controversial ones, maybe. But I would take the simple view that local government has normally acted within the constraints that applied.
Other questions?
You were talking about housing being a kind of reward for having done something else in your life, so like Homes for Heroes. It made me think that that was also the case in Hungary in the 60s and 70s. They had this kind of... They built a lot of flats for like a standard citizen that they'd made up in their head, so there was, you know, two rooms and a kitchen. And you got that as a reward. You moved further up the waiting list if your job had more social worth. And that was how they solved this kind of housing shortage thing, is they had this waiting list. And that's also the case here. If you're in greater need, you move further up the waiting list right now, right, in England. So my question is, both of these countries have allocation systems to get around a housing shortage, but does there always have to be a housing shortage?
Firstly, I'd like to say, in terms of Hungary, that I'm probably one of the few people that actually lived in Hungarian public housing. I lived in a Hungarian tower block flat for a year when I was living and working in Hungary. So I know it a little. Owen, of course, is the great expert on sort of European housing and so on, Eastern European.
You were asked the question.
Eastern European housing. I mean, you ended up with a very sort of straightforwardly political question, didn't you? Should there be a housing shortage, or will there always be a housing shortage? I mean, the answer to that should be no. We need the political will. We need to have the kind of breadth of vision and the energy and aspiration to house our people. It's as simple as that. And we have the resources. We have the means. But we haven't had the political will, or maybe the political pressure from below to do that. That's a rather glib response to your question. You ranged across some other things as well, which I haven't addressed.
I mean, I can think of a couple of examples where shortages have not completely eliminated, get pretty close to it. One of the things that always struck me about the story, which I don't think is in the book, but about the sort of the notorious Hume Crescents in Manchester when they were... which within a few years of them being built sort of collapsed in a sort of social alternative cultures were using them. And the city then had a policy of just like, well, we'll just move them onto all the empty houses that we have in the cottage estates in Burnage and Withenshaw, because we've got shitloads. We've got loads of housing and the population of the city is declining, and basically people can live wherever the hell they want. But that lack of shortage was in many ways caused by Manchester's sort of demographic collapse and economic decline. So I guess there's a question there which is more about whether or not you can have economic growth and a fair allocation of housing at the same time, which I think is much more of a much more intractable question.
Yeah, do I need to respond? I think I'll leave it. I think I'll pause.
All right, you have to choose. Okay,
you've got the mic. Okay, you're nearest.
Cheers. Just what do you think was the biggest design flaw of post-war social housing?
I think the biggest design flaw of post-war social housing was building tower blocks with lifts that didn't work regularly and reliably. You know, it would have made a remarkable difference to people's lives, but also the kind of story and narrative that emerged had people built lifts that worked, maintained them regularly and properly, and so on. I mean, sorry, that's not quite as sort of facetious a response as it sounds. In the obvious design flaw is around system building, which was not entirely, but you know, seen clearly in some cases in the Hume Crescents, and most notoriously, you know, it was just really shoddily constructed. It was built much better elsewhere, so it didn't have to be that way, but it was, given the supervision and the kind of conglomerates, the corporations that were involved. So system building is an obvious thing. I think the design flaw, the essential design flaw, is not high rise. High rise is perfectly acceptable and desirable housing for many people, a cross section of the population, probably not ideal for young children, obviously. But you know, it suited many millions of people over the years, and now suits the affluent middle classes, so it can't be that bad. So I don't slag off high rise. But I do think councils had the responsibility to make sure that their tower blocks were working efficiently and effectively for the people that lived in them.
So you've kind of outlined two responses that social housing was used to. There are two problems that social housing is used to fix. One phase of social housing, sort of interwar, that is a reward, and then another phase of social housing, which is designed to fix the lack of housing created by the Blitz and also slums. So that's sort of housing as reward, housing as ending a shortage. In the period today, we don't actually technically have a housing shortage, at least in sort of like if you take it in a square foot term. And also, there's no sort of real need to socially reward. So I was wondering, what problem are we using social housing to fix, and how does that how should that change the shape of the social housing we intend to build?
Well, a need for social housing, of course, is as powerful and strong now as it's ever been. Given the huge numbers on waiting lists, and these are waiting lists which have been kind of radically pruned to limit them as far as possible, but millions of people on waiting lists, and of course millions of people in the private rental sector that don't really qualify for council housing would be delighted, I'm sure, to have a social landlord. So the need is there, and as you say, maybe there's a hidden housing shortage, isn't there, in terms of obvious homelessness, but more so hidden homelessness. So the housing shortage exists. The need is still there, so I think the imperative to build social housing as part of a mix which provides a genuine housing reservoir for all that need it, as you know, alongside own occupation, obviously, is as powerful today as ever.
We've got time for a couple more.
There's a story about Lena Jager, who was the Labour MP for Holborn, canvassing in a council block around here, I guess, and asking the voter to support Labour because of its nuclear disarmament policy, and being told, well, why would I vote for Labour to manage nuclear disarmament when it can't manage this block properly? And I suppose I'd be really interested for your reflections on that inability, or certainly the story of the inability of local authorities to actually manage the stock sufficiently, which I guess also helped to kind of ruin its reputation.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Lena Jager was no fan of the sort of Regent's Park estate and so on. She's on record as being quite very critical of that housing barrack. She described it as looking like barracks, I think. Well, you know, I kind of gave paternalism a bit of a pass, I guess. But I think it's true to say that Labour councils did become complacent. They did become moribund in the 70s, particularly where their sort of political foothold was secure, as it were. And that, of course, is the interesting thing about the 80s. You know, I think in lots of ways, in nearly all ways, in fact, I think probably management, and this is actually a terrible thing to say, I just realised in the context of Grenfell, which is, you know, the most awful contradiction of what I'm about to say. But I think to some degree, a terrible exception. Housing management has improved, you know, it has improved, and it improved in the 1980s with new left councils that did decentralise, that did, you know, look at other forms of management and so on, did realise they needed to become more responsive, more, and you get the language of customer, you know, customer oriented at this point. So there were, I think, genuine attempts on the new left to do that, and of course there were attempts which were pretty much imposed by the Tories, not as friends of local government, but as enemies. But nevertheless, there were some, I think, beneficial consequences in terms of council of housing management, and housing associations, of course, were seen as in that period as representing a gold standard of a better, more responsive, more agile, and responsible management. That's not always the case nowadays, I think, because they become equally kind of bureaucratic and monolithic or large scale in some cases. But I think the cultural shift towards more decentralised responsive management was important and necessary, and I think the criticisms that were made were in many cases not all justified earlier.
Yeah, one more.
There's a lot of talk now in policy about placemaking. And at its worst, I think it's vacuous marketing. But at its best, I think it's interesting and important about whole communities and infrastructure beyond housing and housing in context. And I've reflected a bit on, historically at least, we talked about civic pride and perhaps associate that with other kinds of buildings, town halls, libraries and so on and so forth. So I was wondering if you had any reflections on the divergence, kind of historic and present, between how we think about, or people or politicians or whoever you wish to think about housing under that umbrella as opposed to other kinds of building which are also in place and which also belong to all of us potentially in that context.
Yes. Shall I answer what you think?
Yes.
The thing that always the thing that always strikes me with this is signs. Like even before sort of going into things like building maintenance, if you go around your average London County Council estate, you will find the sign that was put, in many cases, you will find the sign that was in the building when it was built. And that sign will be ceramic, it's usually very high quality, it's usually designed integrally of the architecture, it's usually very good typography, it's usually pretty sexy. And then next to it, there will be some sort of little piece of plastic affixed by like Southwark Council or Lewisham Council or so, or what have you, that will look awful. And it's almost as if to sort of say, you might be thinking that this building is of high quality. You might be thinking we're proud of it. Well, we're not. Look how not proud of it we are. And that sort of decline in sort of municipality sort of design standards even, I think really sort of shows that these things are all sort of a total afterthought. And they've been forced into that, I think, to a large degree. I don't think that even if they wanted to, in many cases, that they could, you know, have a sort of decent program of sort of properly renovating estates and of restoring all of those sorts of things on a sort of borough-wide or city-wide scale, because the central government simply wouldn't let them in many cases. But that's the thing that always strikes me: the sort of not the good sign with the shit sign next to it.
That's probably true. And hats off to the LCC and some very, you know, progressive and good local councils which had really strong, you know, architectural departments and so on. Of course, and that's the great loss in the current era, is the loss of the public sector architect, you know, and that ethos of service. I think in terms of kind of placemaking and housing, of course, the kind of the acme was the sort of post 45, the great drive to create neighbourhoods, never quite fulfilled, and probably too kind of static and sort of unrealistic really ever to work, because actually people, in the end, people make places rather than places make people, as it were. So I'm a little bit sceptical about placemaking as a philosophy, to be honest. But I think that was the neighbourhood idea was certainly a powerful one in the post-war period, and probably did represent some attempt to create the kind of conscious and sort of corporate community that you identify.
I think we're at time. Thank you.
It'd just be interesting to think if we do get a Labour-led government in the near future with the return of council housing, which is quite a big push on the Labour left and the Labour Party generally now. Do you think we'll see a return to more high-rise, council-led architecture kind of ideals, or will we see a new kind of radicalism come forward?
I think in an urban context, you know, multi-story housing is going to be the thing. You know, not necessarily high-rise, but sort of depending on where you kind of place the numbers, but certainly medium-rise. I hope and believe that we will return to a much larger program of council house building and social house building. I think it will not replicate what's come before. I think a lot's changed, and a lot has, in some ways, has changed for the better. I think it's legitimate to talk about tenure blind housing, which doesn't sort of differentiate and segregate council housing. I think it's quite reasonable to talk about pepper potting, so you can move away from the kind of large estates. That I'm not an enemy of those estates, but I think times have changed. So, and I think, you know, given, this is more of a London issue than elsewhere, perhaps, but given land shortages and so on, I think we're going to be talking about kind of myriad of rather, you know, small scale schemes rather than anything sort of monumental as in the past.
I mean, I would probably disagree with that slightly, insofar as I think it was that there's been so much sort of denigration of council housing. Something which I think only now are we sort of starting to kind of redress and starting to get away from, and I think it was something, one of the things that this book very much does. And even sort of some of the things in the Labour leadership, I was sort of a bit aghast after Grenfell when Corbyn made some comment about sort of like, well, of course, lots of these estates from the 1970s, so it's really quite bad. And it was like, well, this has nothing to do, even regardless of your feelings about that tower, its design in the 1970s has absolutely less than nothing to do with why it burnt down, killing 71 people. I found that really infuriating, and as a fully paid-up Corbynite, I found that sort of remnant of 70s hippiedom very frustrating. But I suppose to have something then that came along and said, this is municipal housing and we're proud of it. We've not actually, rather than having a sort of tenure-blind housing that sort of tries to look like a sort of ordinary bit of city that has some council housing in it, just having something that sort of shouts from the rooftops, we are council housing and we think it's brilliant. I think that would actually be a really good and progressive thing. Not necessarily that everything should be like that, but I think a few pilot projects that say that do that would be very welcome.
Well, I'm no enemy of municipalism, as you know. But I'd be interested to know what form that would take architecturally. I prefer your answer to mine, actually. I should give you the last word. Suffice to say, I'm intrigued by what form that would take. I've celebrated some great examples of municipal architecture and building in the book, in the blog. So I'd be very happy to see that revived.
Well, thank you very much, John Boughton and Owen Hathley. Please come forward and buy copies of the book. I'm sure the authors will be happy to sign. And let's give them a very warm round of applause.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts.
Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.